Hi, this is Martin, BC. I'm in Fredrik Straga's apartment in Stockholm. Really happy to be here and going to play at Larry's Corner solo, which I don't do very often, by the way. This will be my fourth time ever playing an actual solo performance. I like playing in bands. You know, I like collaboration and I like chemistry, and I think that the best stuff comes from a sum of its components. You know, it's funny, I just thinking of the sum of its components, the time I most got that impression was with Ramones, where I worked on some songs on Brain Drain, and I was like, you know, individually they're capable people and musicians, but together they're like one of the most important, really, pop, rock, and of course punk bands of the 20th century, of the second half of the 20th century. So they make it's stratospherically higher in terms of what they accomplish, you know, together in terms of the sum of it, of their parts. So I very much believe that. So that's why I always try to play with a band. In some cases, I do my band. Then I also do sometimes I do something called a Martin BC Collective, which is a little different than the band because there's no script, there's no songs. It's usually shorter, and it's almost as many people as could possibly work, you know. So it might be like maybe up to 10 or something like that. So, you know, there's a point where it just undermines itself, but I try to push that. So I'm really into collaboration, which I guess really got me into producing records. You know, is I like collaborative efforts, and also honestly, it's a big part of why I've at this point I realize I'm an activist, like a community organizer, protester, activist, and I used to think of it as being something I do on the side, but interestingly enough, I realize I'm always doing it. So I guess there I am, and that was also a lot of the motivation for me. In the music. So, for instance, when I was working with some early hip-hop, like, for instance, Afrika Bambaataa, for instance, I worked on the song Zulu Groove. With Bambaataa, I was really excited about Zulu Nation. That was the collective that he had organized. It reminded me of almost like the hardcore collectives of Long Island and Outer Borough Brooklyn, except this was the Bronx.
Yeah, he tried to stop the gangs from killing each other and have them, you know, battling it out,
right?
At jams instead by breakdancing or rapping, yeah, or DJing.
Yeah, so he had this whole collectivist vision, you know, anarchist really vision. No state, no market, and so that was very exciting. So here I am, you know, very active in Black Lives Matter, you know, last year, but at the same time, there I was, you know, really like excited to work with Bambaataa, and Zulu Nation was very exciting to me. That was a very big vision. But and then eventually, when I got into bands like with like Sonic Youth, like for instance, there's the song Death Valley 69 that has Lydia Lunch in it and everything. I mean, that had a feminist vibe to it. I mean, that whole group of people were sort of, they were kind of female led. You know, and I was into female led. You know, I was around a lot of male led, and it sort of seemed like female led was actually better and strangely more egalitarian than male led. So I was actually really went down the feminist pipeline, and it seemed like Sonic Youth with Kim Gordon leading, and then also Lydia, who also herself raps in politics all the time. So that was very exciting. You know, so. It's funny because recently I did a song on my new album called A Storm Called Ida. And what's funny about that song is we got clobbered by a hurricane in New York City, a hurricane that they couldn't even predict. And the reason they couldn't predict it is there was no data for it, because all the records were broken and all the data was outdated and obsolete because of climate change. And actually someone died, which I mentioned in the song. So we had, in New York City, we had 13 people killed from a storm that they didn't even know was coming, at least not at that intensity. And 11 people drowned in their basements, and one person died, drowned on the street in my neighborhood. So I decided to do a song. And interestingly enough, on this song, it's an example of my deliberately trying to do something accessible, because I kind of don't. In fact, it's funny, the whole movement I was a part of, No Wave, that's kind of what it was about. Because people ask me, what was No Wave? Because it's so varied. Some of it was like funky and kind of danceable, and some of it was like kind of noisy and angular, and, you know, but I think the bottom line was that it was boldly inaccessible. Like, it was boldly not commercial, and it, in that sense, went against the grain and was a counterweight to New Wave, right? So New Wave was trying to be as poppy, trying to be poppy, and No Wave was bucking that, you know. And even in my own music, like on my last album, you know, except for that one song, A Storm Called Ida, I try to undermine the poppiness a little bit. I try to have poppiness as just a layer. There's a layer of poppiness and melody that, you know, I don't mind trying to be a little catchy, but I'm kind of undermining it with dissonance and abrasive textures and this sort of thing. But yeah, Storm Called Ida, you know, we're on this in the music video. We actually recreated some of our protests in the activist group I'm a part of, Voice of Gowanus. So yeah, I really tied in rebellion, you know, cultural revolution. That's what it's always been about for me.
Let's listen to A Storm Called Ida, your own song.
During the storm called Ida.
There's something kind of biblical about a flood just destroying everything that's been created by gentrification for the past 10 years. Like, God sends his wrath over Brooklyn.
Right. Well, I mean, whoever.
And yet you kind of look like a cult leader in your red robe in the video.
Yeah. I mean, I have to give.
And your long hair.
Yeah, I have to give credit to the video director, who was her name is Ego Sensation, who's in the band White Hills, who, by the way, I've worked with and just finished doing some recording for. So I think she's very theatrical, so she pushed, also because I try to leave the director's vision there, and also I have a long relationship with the director, so she knew I'm theatrical, basically, and she knows I have this side of me that goes for. I mean, I had this other old record of mine called Sirens of the Apocalypse, which was also sort of based on like Greek myths and stuff like that. For some reason, the sort of Greek myth, tragic comedy dichotomy has always been something that captivated me. So when the Department of Weather or whatever named the storm Ida and then it demolished us, I saw a whole vision there for, like, you know, of nature, benevolent nature, but at the same time destructive. So, like, the voice in the female voice who that personifies the storm in this song, there's this woman, Sarah Fantry, from a band I'm working with in a record that's soon to come out, but this band in New York called Weeping Icon. And so her voice is supposed to sound at the same time destructive but one of the community, so one of us. So it's like this kind of paradox.
Could we go back a little bit in time? Your parents came from Argentina.
Yes.
And your mother was a famous concert pianist.
Yes, yes.
Her name was
Marisa Regules.
Yes. And your father was a doctor, right?
That's right.
And did they encourage you to play music?
Oh, absolutely. My dad, I just discovered I found some tapes of him doing some panels and discussions, and some of it was medical, and then some of it was supporting the arts and trying to get more funding in American universities for the arts, in particular particularly classical music. So he was a music and arts, like, advocate. I was sent to, I was given instruction, which did not go very well. So I think I disappointed my parents because I did not do well with
violin. So did you try the piano or did you try the...
Well, piano was what they tried.
The cello?
That didn't work very well. And then they tried violin and that didn't work very well. They might have tried something else and then they kind of gave up. And I was very sad because I thought, wow, I don't have any music talent. I guess it was just the wrong instruments and the, you know... But my dad also, I mean, my parents had art around the house. They had a lot of, I guess what they used to call primitive art, but we don't call it that anymore, of course, from Africa and from Oceania. And I had to learn all of it. Like I had to learn where the pieces came from, what the names of the different tribes and nations were. So they were very concerned about like arts education and stuff.
And you lived on the Upper East?
I live on the Upper East Side, yeah.
And they were quite wealthy, I assume. Or,
I mean, in reality, they were rich people.
Yeah.
It's just that when you live on the Upper East Side, I'm just saying, there's a whole other level of rich. And my parents were, you know, my parents were not in finance. They were not bankers. So my dad was a doctor. So yeah, it's rich. We are talking rich people here.
And this is your mother playing Rachmaninoff.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
She must have practiced a lot. You know, this is like Yngwie Malmsteen level of technical control.
Yeah, yeah, way to intimidate me, Frederick, when I have to go in like 3 hours and play solo in a record store. Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, it's just mind-boggling, her talent. You know, if I've just a piece of that talent, I must have something, I guess, because music is really hard. I think music is really hard. So I've kind of gotten the idea over the years that really you don't pursue music unless there's some thread of natural, you know, ability, because otherwise it's just too difficult. So maybe I've gotten the feeling that maybe my path, my entry point was rhythm, because after all those other instruments failed with me, I did have a drum kit when I was a teenager that I played, and you know, I never pursued that, like, to be in a band or to record, but I started on drums. So I think I have something. And then the rest is hard work. But something's got to give you pleasure, right, in music. It's just too hard, the training and the ideas. So something's got to come like, okay, this is easy and feels good. So that's got to happen.
Some parents who are into classical music don't really like their kids to listen to rock. But your parents apparently gave you a Grateful Dead album at some point.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because I got some compilation record. This is, I think I was like 10 or 11. I got some compilation record, and then there was like some classical piece on it. And I don't know, I just kind of, I don't know, thought I'd impress my, this, I mean, I was really young. I thought I'd impress my parents that I had a record that had some classical music on it. I don't know, and that it somehow was something that I discovered. So I played it for my parents, and I don't even know if it was classical music. It just had classical instruments. So I played it for my parents, and they were just like, the looks on their faces, they were just appalled. And they made very clear that like it was, I don't even know how they said it, because it's kind of a high concept to communicate to like a 10-year-old, but that they would, that the other stuff that I listened to that potentially was better on its own terms, what's much better than something mediocre.
Pretending to be classical.
Yeah, just because of that really was not the relevant point. And it's funny, it was definitely consensus between the two. They were both sitting there. They no discussion. They both recognized it as garbage.
But they did give you a Grateful Dead record.
Yeah. That was the first record that my mom gave me. One of the reasons
was... Interesting choice.
Well, it's funny. Apparently, it was recommended. Apparently, because she was... Because she never went to school, because she... her dad, so my grandfather, was a senator. And so she had a very cloistered life in Argentina. And my grandmother, so her mom, was a music manager, and my grandmother's sister was also an opera singer, by the way. So it was a big musical thing. My great aunt sang with Caruso and stuff. So it was my mom's aunt sang with Caruso, and then my mom, blah blah blah, and her mom was a manager, right? So. They really had her like practicing piano like all the time and studying piano and got tutored. So she was very educated, but she never actually went to school and never went into university, because by the time she was 18, she had an exploding career, right? I think her career started when she was a teenager.
She was in a movie too, right?
And she was in a film and she was going to be in films in the United States. Like her lawyer was Marilyn Monroe's lawyer, who I met. So there was, you know, she had the Marilyn Monroe's photographer, the person that did that took the photo of Marilyn on top of a subway grate with a skirt that goes up. Yeah, that photographer took photos of my mom. So, yeah, she was in show business. She was going to potentially be in show business. I don't know why exactly that part of it didn't happen.
But you didn't get to meet Marilyn Monroe yourself.
No, I did not. But also that lawyer represented Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, and I think I might have met them. So whatever, this was the world. But yeah, my mom was practicing piano all the time. So even before she died, she was practicing every night. So I went to bed every night with her piano playing in my ear. And I gotta say, I have wondered whether that influenced my inclination towards lots of layering and sort of more orchestral view of some of the music we're talking about. So I can do stripped down for sure. I can do stripped down and in your face, but it seems like a little bit more of my specialty is lots of layers. So I'm maybe a little more comfortable with like a shoegaze direction, let's just say. But yeah, to answer your question, when I was a kid, a toddler, she was eager to go to music school, and she studied conducting, orchestra conducting. I think she also studied electronic music. This was in the 60s. So I remember her bringing me to class, and it was like all hippies. I remember that very clearly. I was like, whoa, this is like all hippies. This is my mom, you know, who like was born in 1922. And she was very happy, actually, in the, you know, she loved the 60s, it seemed. She thought it was very exciting, and I liked this. I liked the 60s. I remember the 60s in New York City, so it's kind of something. So I think that she got recommended the Grateful Dead record by other students. That's what I think happened. And they recommended, oh, you got to listen to Anthem of the Sun, Grateful Dead, and you got to listen to Extrapolations by that's good for your kid. So the other one, those two records that came together was Grateful Dead, Anthem of the Sun, and John McLaughlin, Extrapolations.
Both your parents died when you were a kid, basically, or you were an orphan at 17. First your mother when you were 12?
Yes.
And then your dad?
When I was seven.
Five years later. What happened to them?
Illness.
Illness, okay.
Yeah, it's also why I don't eat a lot of meat, because they were Argentinians and ate a lot of meat all the freaking time. So I don't really know, but I'm like, you know, I got to do something a little different than my parents. And then one thing I decided to make a little different is not like freaking eat. Like
the only country that eats more beef than Texas.
Yeah, no doubt. Like there's no meal with no meat, like red meat. So that's one thing I've cut out. Just
so they got cancer, or is that?
Yeah,
it?
Both got cancer. Okay. My dad colon cancer.
And
mom.
You didn't live with any step parents or anything at 17.
It was very strange. I don't know why, but actually, Elizabeth Taylor's lawyer felt that I could just get away with just floating through those last 6 months until I became of age. So that was a strange time in New York. I had an apartment all to myself. I felt guilty about it in the end because I would have parties and some pretty amazing stuff. Like it's amazing who I would actually have in my parents' apartment.
Like,
you know, but well, because I was really getting into graffiti then. And even before my dad died, I feel guilty about it. But even while my dad was ill in New Mexico with cancer and on his way, I would go visit him. But then when I came back, I had the apartment to myself and I was writing graffiti. So I had these little parties sometimes with, like maybe a handful of times, with graffiti artists from really like the depths of Brooklyn at the time, which was like heavy gangland and stuff. And there was never any problems. So it was really funny to have... because really what's funny is graffiti artists were the arts wing of gangs, right? They would get gang protection, for instance, right? So you'd have these artists, which were all visual artists, because one thing I learned about like the real deal, I was what you call a toy, right? I did graffiti. I'd go out, I know we couldn't use this language today, but I'd go out bombing the trains. That would be the word I used. So I'd go bomb and, you know, but that's all I did. Everyone knew I was a toy. I was admitted. I was like, I'm not like you all, because you all, like I would see, they would have like, they'd be working on pieces for the trains and they would have these amazing books with like page after page of ideas that they were working on. So it's on that level in terms of visual artists. So, you know, I'm not there, whatever. But so those are little parties at my house. This was before I discovered music. This was before I discovered that you could do anti-music, right? I thought there was a lot of rebellious music. You know, I thought of Jimi Hendrix as rebellious music, but I hadn't discovered, like, quote, experimental music. I hadn't discovered no wave.
And this was before anything was called hip-hop as well, right? Graffiti was something on its own.
Well, that's actually a very important thing to recognize. And some of my my peers in graffiti from the time have made a point of trying to clarify this, is graffiti predates hip-hop. Generally, we think of graffiti as having started in 1972. We think of it as having started in Philadelphia. It was all over New York City. It was not confined to the Bronx. And, you know, hip-hop invited in the graffiti artists that were in that community, so we associated it with the two. But hip-hop was this much broader thing. What's funny is, even without getting into music, before really diving into, you know, experimental and adventurous music, I remember, like, in 1979, being on a train with a boombox and blasting Kraftwerk Trans-Europe Express, you know, in like 1977, whenever that came out. So a lot of my friends, and we're talking like Puerto Rican kids, right? So we're talking like, because, you know, I'm Latinx, right? So some of my kids, I mean, there was some Jewish graffiti artists that were notable. It was like, for some reason, it was that and Puerto Ricans and some black kids, but mostly Puerto Ricans in my group of graffiti writers. And we were listening to like krautrock, right? So we were listening to Kraftwerk.
Really? Wow.
Right? So we weren't, there was no word for graffiti, for hip hop. And we weren't, we weren't listening to hip hop. What could we be doing? Actually, we weren't actually even listening to black music. Right? And it's also interesting how krautrock was really influential in New York City in that community. I mean, you can see that the whole, because really what you had with Afrika Bambaataa was a sort of Afrofuturism, right? And you can see that even in the song Rocket. You can see how even the title of the Herbie Hancock, the title of the Herbie Hancock record is Future Shock, right? So there was a real African American thing that the future can't just be the domain of white people, and the vision for the future can't just be the vision of white people. We have our own vision for the future. So that was like, and so it was inspiring. They wanted to be part of the future. So for instance, breakdancing. Does relate to the sort of kraut rock. Think of craft work like the other robots, dung, dun, 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 right? And so you have the breakdancing that goes along with that. Afrika Bambaataa, not a record I worked on, but he did, you know, Planet Rock, I guess, which was based on craft work. So, yeah, so that's where it existed in the beginning.
And this is a track that you did work on, Zulu Groove by Afrika Bambaataa.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You started to do the sound at the legendary club CBGB's in the early 80s. How did that come about?
Well, what I started doing, it was more of like volunteering. And I was a bit of an apprentice, so I wasn't like I wasn't in the staff. There was a sound person there, Charlie Martin, who was kind of excited to basically have a little more time off. And I think now that I've understood, when you're older, sometimes you do like, it's natural, it's human. You do like to impart knowledge and information to younger people, right? So that happened with me. So the sound person at CBGB's saw a little bit of himself in me, which was, I was like all excited about doing sound. And he was a little, maybe, who knows, maybe a little over it at that point. So I could volunteer to do sound for bands. Sometimes I'd ask bands to do sound for them. And that's where I kind of learned my ropes. And then when the first console I got at the studio, since I did not know better, I got a copy. I got the same board as I saw in CBGB's, the live soundboard. I got it at the studio. So the first, for instance, part of Rocket was recorded on a Soundcraft live board that was an exact same one as the one that was at CBGB's. So I would just volunteer. The thing that happened is I didn't go to CBGB's and say, because I was like 17, right? So I didn't go to see, I wasn't even legal in CBGBs. So Bill Laswell, who I met him when I was 17, and basically literally at the meeting, like when the day that I met Bill Laswell, I was introduced to John Zorn's music. And my mind exploded, and I was ready to freaking work, basically, you know. The reason I met Laswell is because I was in theater class in my high school in the Bronx, and he had met, we were all kind of a little collective, we were all a group of people, Michael Beinhorn, who eventually became, I knew him since high school, so Michael Beinhorn, who eventually was part of Material with Bill Laswell.
The band that Laswell had, yes.
Yeah, so he eventually was part, then also Fred Marr, who later worked with like Lou Reed, and Information Society and stuff like that. He was younger than us. He was like 14. So we were like 17, 18. Fred Barr was like 14. And they went to meet Bill Laswell because they answered an ad in the paper, because Laswell had just arrived from Detroit and was like looking for people to collaborate with. And they told him about, because I was roommates, they told him about me, about me being in theater school, and I was into doing stuff like set design and stuff like that. And he goes, well, let me meet Martin. So I go to meet Laswell, and he saw a plan with me. So basically he saw me as potentially on the technical side, someone that was willing to learn and to do things, and he immediately, pretty much immediately, because, you know, with music you always need help, right? So he immediately pretty much had me as a roadie. And of course, the idea of potentially learning how to do sound and then doing sound and having someone to do sound, that seemed appealing. So he got me into CBGBs to learn about sound. And of course, I was happy about that.
And then you decided to open a studio together with money from Brian Eno, which is fascinating in itself.
Yeah.
He kind of financed it.
Really what happened was Laswell's idea was maybe we should get a loft. Loft being a sort of former industrial space, right? Like one of those big spaces, right? Very popular at the time, like Lower Manhattan. A lot of the industrial neighborhoods were sort of converting and being taken over by artists. It's kind of a global phenomenon. Right around that time, 1979, 80, you had also squats all over Europe where they would, like, you know, sometimes violently, like, take over, like, a former factory or something like that, right? So we did that legally. It was Laswell's idea. He goes, let's get a loft. And I was like, you know, that sounds like a great idea. And we couldn't do it in Soho because already all the fancy artists were starting to move into Soho. So that was out. So I had the bright idea of going to Brooklyn, which no one did back then. In a weird way, I might have been one of the first people as artists to move. I mean, there was some arts in Brooklyn, but one of the first people not from Brooklyn to decide maybe that's where we should settle.
And this was 1981?
This was 1979.
1979.
Yeah, 1979. That's early. And that was the simple idea. It was the simplest of ideas, which was just like, we'll get a loft, we can live there, we can have music, we can have set up some instruments, do rehearsals, and who knows. And then we got the space in summer of 1979.
In Gowanus,
and the same place I occupy now.
Yeah, what was that area like back then?
Well, it was a war zone, you know. It was a war zone. Yeah, it was a police no-go zone. So unless there was blood involved, they were not going to come. And you know, it was dangerous. It was gangland. But you know, it's funny that I realized that I could have better relationships with those criminals than I could later with, like, developers and stuff, which is a different kind of, you know, legalized crime in a way. So I was like, wow, I get along. I'm safer amongst the gangs. And actually, it's funny because I didn't suffer any, like, crime. I didn't. I got to admit that other people suffered crimes, so I don't want to just say that it was a safe time.
I thought you and Bill Laswell got mugged, like, the first time you went there by...
Well, mugged wasn't necessarily violent.
By this gang called the Crazy Homicides.
That's what happened. Yeah, we got mad. That was the gang. That was the gang that, quote, terrorized, you know, the neighborhood. And they mugged. But getting mugged, I mean, when I was almost a toddler, I'd get mugged about once a month. So I was getting mugged, like, all the time. by other kids. So that happened. So when me and Laszlo got mugged, it wasn't even that unusual to get mugged.
I watched this great documentary about you and BC Studios called Sound and Chaos, where they mention another gang called the Confederates that would wear Confederate hats. Were those guys white or black?
No, those were the crazy homicides.
They're the same gang. Okay,
that's the same gang. Yeah, they wore these like Civil War like hats, like Confederate hats. Yeah, those were all Latinx people, like Puerto Ricans, and like, you know, like leather jackets. But the hats were kind of fun.
A creative way to scare people. You know, where the Confederacy?
Yeah, it was strange. You know, at the time I was like, is that what I think it is? I didn't know, but they were they got into intense battles with other gangs there. So there was like other gangs around there. There was the Sunset Skins, who were the band. They were the gang from Sunset Park, which is like the next. They were the gang from the next neighborhood, which was Sunset Park. So the Sunset Skins. There were the Staten Island Sickies, which were from another borough that would occasionally come into Gowanus to buy drugs or something like that. And so then there would be a battle. There was an infamous battle a few blocks from that people still talk about that involved a lot of people ending up in the hospital and stuff. So it was some crazy stuff.
Didn't you get like hurt quite recently?
Yeah.
There was this fundraiser for your medical bills.
Yeah. So I got really hurt and assaulted and stuff. But what's funny is that was with gentrification. So gentrified. In fact, I remind people of that. It's like you might be reading it wrong. You know, it's really this human assumption that when we see a lot of activity on the street and we see a bar there and that it makes it safer. You got to recalculate these things. That maybe not. You know, maybe people are stalking the people that come out of the bar, for instance. So I got mugged. I think mugged and assaulted and badly. Right.
What happened?
Well, they came up to me from behind and swung what I call a blackjack. It's a blackjack. It's basically which I didn't see, some kind of large piece of metal like in something that swings, and it swung across my face. So it could have been, of course, as usual with these things, of course it could have been worse, but truly it could have been a lot worse. But they smashed my teeth. You know, I lost some teeth. And I think that they intended to knock me out. But, you know, across the street was Whole Foods. So across the whole streets was this like, you know, rich people thing. And then 2 months later, the studio gets robbed for the first time. And then as one of my friends said to me, it didn't help to be across the street from Whole Foods. And that shows you that the gentrification, really the problem was inequality. It was but before there was just less inequality because what was in this abandoned factory, you know, now it's no longer abandoned, but the fact that the former factory where my studio is, the whole building projects wealth. Like not me particularly, but some of the other tenants or the design, it's been renovated. There's these big open windows. You can look inside. There's like offices with computers and stuff. And it just projects wealth. So it becomes a target for crime. And, you know, I was walking, I wasn't at the bar, but I thought later that possibly my leaving a hipster bar, you know, actually contributed to the assault and the robbery because they figured I was drunk and had money. So, that was gentrified Brooklyn, actually a little more dangerous.
How much did you work with Eno after he financed the studio?
Well, that's the thing is
because he didn't stay for that long, did he?
No, he didn't. The reality is I tried to start the studio and bought a little bit of equipment and did not understand what having a professional studio entailed or what was completely involved. So I actually didn't make the best choices. In some ways, in retrospect, I made good choices because I shot too high. Right, because I got criticized by Bill Laswell and by a few people. Say, you should have just gotten an 8-track, you know. Then we could be doing something, right? Rather than getting a 16-track that then we can't do anything with, right? So, but in the end, I shot high and ran out of money, and that's what it was. And then Laswell, he's the one because he was a hotshot bass player. He did some sessions, I believe, even for David Bowie. I think his tracks didn't end up on those songs, but he played on some. So he was a studio musician. So he got to meet Brian Eno, and Brian Eno lived near where Laswell lived. So I think they saw each other on the street. So Laswell had the idea of seeing if he could get Eno interested in recording at this space, and that was kind of a stroke of genius, really, because you would think that Eno would just stick to nice, finished, functional studios. But the reality was that Eno found it quite compelling to come to this sort of space that was like in a crazy, you know, dilapidated part of Brooklyn. Because here's the thing is, Eno, this was a special time for Brian Eno in New York City. It was the special 5 years. It started in 1977 with him working on the record No New York, where in a way he's helped start No Wave. Some people that were doing No Wave, some people saw that it could go somewhere. Most of the people, like myself, didn't think it was going to go anywhere. Just like I thought with hip-hop. I didn't think hip-hop was going to go anywhere either, right? So I didn't think No Wave was going to... I was more typical in that way. I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. I'd say it's experimental, it's noisy, and it was extreme in a lot of ways, right? So it was pushing a lot of limits. I think also even sexually. I think it was also like boldly transgressive and pushing sexuality, because this was a time of this sort of increased conservatism. There was like the, you know, like, for instance, our presidential candidate, Al Gore, and his wife had what they call the PMRC, which was about trying to get obscenity out of music and obscene lyrics and obscene content out of music. And it was serious stuff. I mean, the Republican Party in the United States was pulling funding out of the arts based on what they were calling obscenity, right? So it was like the moral police. So we were trying to do stuff. So many of us were trying to be as, you know, sexually forward, as obscene as can be. And so there, in terms of lyrics, it was more sexualized, more violent even, right? So it was really pushing. It was like, and actually that's why there was the movement of transgression, which is breaking taboos. So the society was doubling down on taboos, and we were trying to break them down. So that's part of No Wave as well.
Movie makers like Nicky Zed and maybe Richard Kern?
Yeah, exactly.
Who incidentally made the video for Death Valley 69.
Right, so he was a hero. He was a hero to a lot of us.
Let's listen to that track.
Let's, absolutely.
Basically, Sonic Youth and Lydia Lunch were maybe the most famous artists to come out of the No Wave movement.
I guess so. The most long lived in a way.
And you worked on this record, Bad Moon Rising.
Yes.
Which is the second Sonic Youth album, or
I believe it's the first long play. I believe it's the first LP. There was other stuff like Flower, I think. There was some EPs and singles before that, but I think Death Valley was the first long play LP.
And you worked as an engineer on this.
Yeah. I think I might have a co-production credit on that. I don't really know, and I also don't really care.
So where do you really draw the line between engineering and production? Because in your case, you've sort of been floating between those roles and the role of a musician, of course.
Yeah, well, I think it's always a co-production. I mean, there's times when it might seem like more like I'm a producer, just because I get more involved. So when I get more involved, you could say, well, I'm a little more like a producer. But even when I'm going, like, crossing into that territory where I'm really being more of a producer, for instance, commenting on songwriting, for instance, then that's more of a producer, right? Going to rehearsals, that's more of a producer. Even then, it's still a co-production. Right, because it's still, you got to like find middle ground, you got to work together. So it's a co-production. And then, of course, when I'm doing none of that and I'm just worrying about the sounds and getting the right sounds, it's still a co-production. So it's always co-production.
Is it true that both Sonic Youth and the Beastie Boys assumed that you were Native American?
It could be. No one explicitly said that. They all thought I looked Native American, that's for true. And I think I played that up because, I mean, it's funny with the whole thing of identity. You know, I think at the time I was more concerned with like identity. What's my ancestry? Where do I actually come from? Because the older generation just basically lied, right? So my parents didn't tell me anything. They wouldn't even tell me I was part Italian, right? So they just didn't. It was just like, all you need to know is puro español. You're just Spanish. That's it. Because that's that was the dominant culture from where they came from. So no one was. So I was interested in these things. Plus, as you can see with the name of my studio, which wasn't the name of the studio right away, was when I split up from Bill Laswell. It was called BC, right? BC. What it had nothing to do with Christ, by the way. It had to do with
Your last name, BC.
Well, yes, but now I would call it before Common Era, right? In other words, it had to do before the modern world. So, like the even the logo for BC Studio at the time looked like cavemen had did it. It looked like the Flintstones, and one of my and in the logo, which was really embarrassing and stupid, I had a dinosaur in there. There's even some images of me with like dinosaurs at the studio, right? So the whole idea was I really kind of resented the modern world, even though I was trying to do something kind of destructive. Right, so I was trying to break down the modern world. You can see that in graffiti. I mean, I was literally attacking with paint. I was attacking the modern world. Right, so so that's why the name of the studio was BC, like before Common Era. I forgot where I was going with that.
It's funny because I've seen a few pictures of you from that time, and you kind of look like, you know, a cute version of the pimp that Harvey Keitel plays in Taxi Driver.
Right. Well, everyone says that, and I think in that they call him Chief or something. But yeah, the whole thing with my exploring whether I might, and we don't know whether I have any Native, it wouldn't be Native North American, Native South American blood. We don't know because I haven't taken a DNA test, so I don't know. But entering that proposition that I might have some Native American blood was compelling to me because I really was resenting the modern world.
You were a graffiti artist, and you also worked with Jean-Michel Basquiat in his band Grey that he had with Michael Holman, who was like a scenester within early hip-hop. He had this show called Graffiti Rock, I think, on TV. And also Vincent Gallo was in that band, the actor.
Yeah.
And you worked on their album, or?
Well, there was a Basquiat album that I think was called Test Pressing or something. I mean, it's not a Basquiat record. It's Grey was the name of the record. Grey was the name of the band.
Grey was the name of the band.
I think I did not. I think I did not work on the first one. I did some later recordings. Honestly, I don't know if they came out. I don't know where they are or what happened. But I recorded those. I'm pretty sure Vincent Gallo was in the studio. I knew Vincent Gallo. He was around. He was always trying to sell me microphones because he was a microphone collector. Still is a microphone collector. So I knew him. The only thing I specifically remember of recording Grey, and it was not with Basquiat, because Basquiat kind of came in and out. It was not, we think of Grey as having been Basquiat's band, but I don't think it was really his band. He was just
someone. Michael Holman was more important.
I think that Michael Holman was more the driver. So I did record with Michael Holman and a couple people that I don't quite remember, but interestingly enough, Debbie Mazar was in that, and she was she is actually an actress that was in films like, I believe, Goodfellas.
She's great in Goodfellas.
Okay, so I'm okay. I'm good. I'm right.
Pretty
there.
Sure that's her. Yes, she's Debbie Mazar is in Goodfellas. At least I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah. And she was the mistress.
I had a major crush on her for a while.
So. Yeah. Well, so she was in my studio. She lived up the block, by the way. So she lived in Park Slope, which is just adjacent to Gowanus. She lived there for a few years. So me and my ex-wife, we would like have coffee with her all the time. So she came in and she played clarinet. So isn't that crazy? She played clarinet in a Grey recording. So that was her instrument.
Are you still in touch with Vincent Gallo?
No.
I went to New York to interview him when Buffalo 66, his first movie when it came out in 1998, and I got into kind of a trouble with him because the magazine that I worked for promised to put him on the cover, and they didn't. And then he got very upset, so he would leave very threatening messages on my answering machine at night, which was absurd, saying that I was a socialist chimpanzee, I think. He was very upset.
Yeah.
You know, he does not like people who, that he thinks are left-wing. If I remember it correctly, he said on my answering machine that he would devote his life to destroying our magazine. And it went bankrupt just a year later, so maybe he succeeded, I'm not sure. But he managed to get himself cancelled way before that expression, you know, was used in the way we use it now. I'd like to ask you, what do you think is like the magic of BC Studios, like the building? What makes it so special? Because I was watching this Sound and Chaos documentary where Michael Girard from Swans says that there was enough space in the studio for him to live out his most bombastic Phil Spector dreams, that he could, you know, create a large, overwhelming sound.
Well, that is one thing that strikes people. I have two large spaces that are connected by glass, right? So one space is, you know, really big and impressive, and the other one is big. And usually a drummer walks into into that space and musicians are excited to play in there, like right away, because everything else is like a controlled, designed to not be out of control, right? So a lot of studios, that's actually proper acoustic design, is to make sure it's not completely out of control, you know? And so in my place, you look at it and you realize it's a little like uncontrolled. It's feral in a way. It's a wild space that's natural. There's actually I'm lucky because some of its imperfections actually help it from being completely out of control, right? It can kind of contains the sound just enough.
It's so feral that Michael Girard even had a fight with a huge rat, apparently.
Well, yeah, I'd like to think that I don't have a rat problem anymore, but occasionally there was a rat, and he got very excited about that. And it's on the back of one of the records. I think it's on The Great Annihilator.
Yeah, he killed it somehow.
Oh no, I killed the rat.
You killed the rat. Okay.
I killed the rat, and Girard was very excited about that. It was a little weird. But he was like,
he still kind of moved in with you.
Well, he was staying there.
He was staying there. Oh, so that's how he,
I think, because he was recording.
Met the rat. Okay.
Yeah, and I knew there was a rat. So I tricked the rat to trap it. And because I knew where it was going, so I was sleeping near the rat. I was sleeping near where it happened, so I knew that this could happen, that it would get, this is awful, but that it could get trapped. So it got trapped, and then I knew it. I turned on the lights, and then I went to kill the rat. And then after killing the rat, which was really disgusting, I turned around and realized that Girard was behind me in his shorts and just starting to light a cigar. And he found it just like epic or something. And then he gave me the nickname Rat Crusher, and that appears on the back of the album. Pretty sure it's The Great Annihilator, which is a great record, by the way. So that was also mixed at the studio. It's funny because somehow I think it was the day that Kurt Cobain died. Someone at the record label, which is I think the Chicago record Invisible Records, someone from the label calls up, like really flipping out because she thought I'd be offended. Calls up and goes, oh, blah, blah, blah. I think somehow she thought I would have seen the credits on the album, and I had not, right? So I didn't know what she was talking about. She goes, oh, Martin, I don't know, just want to say that us at the label, we didn't really see this. We never would have been comfortable putting that on the album in your credits, this sort of thing, right? And I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, oh, you didn't see? Well, I'm so sorry, Martin, but Michael called you Rat Crusher. So this is the conversation. And then after I was telling, after I feigned discomfort, I was like, oh, okay, you know, maybe, okay, I think I'm okay with this. I was totally feigning. I couldn't care less. You know, it was fun, right? And then the next thing was, oh, you don't know Kurt Cobain died today, right? So I was like, oh my God, right? So it was that was the same conversation.
And this is Love of Life by Swans.
You know, it's worth saying that song shows you maybe a little bit. I mean, it's really Michael Gerard's vision, right? But sonically, as an engineer, you can see how it helped that I was going to the New York Philharmonic with my parents and listening to orchestras like once a week. So you can see just my ear tuning into like lots of layers in an orchestral. And also, it's a very dramatic sounding song, and sort of also having an affinity for drama. I also got to say that song, Love of Life, still holds the record of the longest mix at the studio. 5 days. That's extreme.
And why did it take so long?
Because we did like 17 versions, starting from scratch every time, sort of thing. Michael never being quite happy, and there's a point where maybe you have to just start over, so it kept happening. And then, of course, every time we think we're done, I'm really wondering how different it was from the original version or the previous version. But whatever, just endless. That took a long time. But that was also a time in the studio where we just had, it was a different ethic, you know? Where people, it was like art first, health second. It was like art first, mental health, good luck. That was that era. Now it's like mental health first, then you create. So it's a different thing.
Material, the band with Bill Aswell and Michael Beinhorn, their third album, One Down from 1982, featured a singer who was later to become extremely famous, Whitney Houston. But she didn't go to Brooklyn to record her vocals, right?
Yeah, she did not.
She was the only part of that song that you didn't record.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I did not work on that, on her. It's also funny because which keeps happening, is like, you know how they talk in the industry of golden ears? Right, which is the person in the business who can really tell you which band is going to succeed, or they can hear some raw talent and go, that's the one, that's the next star, or they hear an album and they just go, that's going to be the hit. I am not that person. It's funny. I am almost a counterindication, right? The thing that I think doesn't matter, that's the thing that's gonna click, right? The thing that I think is kind of like, I feel sorry for that artist. Wow, they're really trying, but they just don't have it. That's the one that really resonates with people. So it's almost a counterindication. That song, I just didn't really think anything of it. But what's funny is now, even musically, even just taking aside that it's the most commercial song on the record, and I don't really care that much about being commercial, musically speaking. Still, musically, you know, it's got the sax player Hopper on it, and
it's Archie Shepp.
Yeah,
right.
The writer is Hugh Hopper, I think. Anyway, maybe fact check me on that, but yeah, Archie Shepp. So that's a musical powerhouse, amazing playing, actually saxophone, amazing like first take kind of thing. And also, it's a fantastic song because it was originally performed by the Soft Machine, which was a psychedelic band from London, along with Gong, a band like Gong and stuff. So the idea of taking a band a song that was written, that was performed by like psychedelic hippie, like crazy hippie people, and then Whitney Houston on it, and that's like her first single, pretty mind-blowing. blowing, and I'm super proud of having, you know, had something to do with it. But at the time, it seemed like a bit of a throwaway, because it's a ballad, you know, and then there was stuff that I thought was kind of more compelling that now is not that compelling. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on there, you know, I don't know, it may seem compelling again in 15 years, stuff with vocoder. You know, it's stuff like, at the time I thought vocoder, you know, like synthesizer voice. There's a song on there that's like, "Don't Lose Control" with like a synthesizer voice. I thought that was like incredible, right? And now I'm like, okay, well, you know, it's funny.
But the voice effects on Rocket still sound very modern. That's one of your most famous track.
Yeah, it's
Herbie Hancock's Rocket.
Well, there's a reason that I'm not that happy about. There's a reason that Rocket sounds still so current. It's not Rocket. It's that even electronic music now is pretty retro. Like, I'm actually freaking surprised. I mean, people that do electronic music are sounding a lot like rockers sounded like 15 years ago, about like playing a 1962 Les Paul guitar or something like that, or like even now vintage guitar amp, and like so now with electronics too, it's like vintage, you know,
synthesizers by Moog,
modular synthesizers. Yeah. I mean, it's the whole thing of it being futurist music is just gone. In fact, it's funny that now with the sort of resurgence of electronic music basically dominating, like electronic music is just dominating.
Yeah, everything is electronic.
Part of that now also was accelerated, clearly accelerated during and after the pandemic, because people couldn't make bands, people still want to express themselves, and also people had a lot more facility at home, right? So the fact that you can put together things at home and just take the things you took at home and play them and then just play over them at a club rather than having to bring a whole band, right? And so the better home studio kind of environment now, basically electronic music is dominating now. But what's funny is a lot of it is sonically very retro, and I feel less retro when I do things that sound 90s. So I'm actually less retro when I'm playing rock that maybe sounds like mid-90s than people that do like club music that sounds like electronic and sounds like Rocket and sounds like club music of the 70s. So it's actually kind of strange. It's flipped around.
But something that you don't hear in modern hip-hop is scratching. That's pretty much gone. And Rocket was one of the first tracks that really brought that to a mass audience. Rocket, of course, was also the first hip-hop track to get a Grammy, I think.
Yeah, it's funny because at the time I did not understand Rocket to be hip-hop because...
Even though you brought Grandmaster DST on the track.
It's funny, I just didn't think of it that way. And it's one of these things where I don't even know what to call the genre. You know, but I thought because of the melody, whatever it is, right? That melody felt kind of jazzy, right? And the sound was kind of jazzy, and it didn't quote any other music. So a lot of like on the turntablist on Rocket, DST, I recorded his album, right? And then he would like do. He would reference film music. Like I did a track with him where like the chorus or the theme is like the theme from The Exorcist from the film, right? So appropriation seemed like a big part of hip hop. So even though it can be argued that the scratching itself is appropriation, right? Because you're using a record of someone else's to create the scratch.
And you also sampled Led Zeppelin, right, on the same track?
Yeah. So, but since the appropriation was a little downplayed on Rocket, and it was also not purely electronic, the rhythms, right? So the rhythms on Rocket also are bata, Afro-Cuban drums, which are actually Yoruba, like West African sacred drums. So bata drums are fascinating pieces of percussion. So there's on Rocket, interestingly enough, it's not purely electronic. So it wasn't purely a drum machine. So it had hip-hop elements, no rapping. There's no talk of an MC on there, no blatant appropriation. So there was a few fixtures of hip-hop that did not that don't exist on Rocket. And what's good about that, then it completely features the turntable. The fact that I kind of snuck in a Led Zeppelin sample is kind of amazing, because that was sort of just at the last minute, you know, we were messing around because we liked having interesting sounds.
This was like way before you had to clear samples, right? Because
yeah, it was way before that.
That would have been impossible now.
Yeah. Well, also here's the thing is we material did not own samplers, you know? So we had to go through a lot of trouble to actually do anything that would seem like sampling, because samplers were like, they would cost like $60,000, right? So Herbie owned a sampler. I think he owned like a Synclavier, which was like, it was like a huge computer. It would take up a whole side of a room. So it wasn't so easy. So what I had to do...
That was the synthesizer that only really rich artists could afford. I know that Kate Bush had one.
Uh-huh. That's possible. Yeah. So here's the thing.
It's Synclavier, yeah.
Right. But this is that, by the way, right there. The fact that we had to fake it, right? That we had to create things that might sound like samples, but using tape loops, right? Using delays and repeat holds on delay units. That's why it felt kind of avant-garde and experimental to me. So hip-hop felt a little experimental because I had to use experimental techniques just to create interesting sounds. So that's what we were doing, and I captured just a moment because the only thing I could sample was maybe like a quarter second, right? That's the most like that our budget could afford in terms of data was to sample. Like, so we captured like a da-da, that's it, done. Actually, it was not even da-da, it was that, and we had to like hit it twice. So that is is like at the top of every verse of Rockin'. And that's, if you listen carefully, you can kind of hear Jimmy Page's tone in it. So that's fast in a way. That's fascinating that you have these sacred your Reuben drums and like Bronx style scratching, and the scratch itself came from a Fab Five Freddy record, which is who later became the VJ, right?
On MTV.
Yo MTV Raps.
Yo MTV Raps, yes.
Right. So, I mean, it's meta over meta over meta, and everything crosses on that song.
You also worked on Iggy Pop's album Instinct, which came out right after he got some kind of commercial success with Blah Blah Blah, and he wanted to go back to his punk roots. What was that like to record? I think he did his vocals.
Yeah, Iggy recorded his vocals at my place. It's kind of funny because Laswell, we had sort of split apart amicably, but and that's actually my recording studio. The first name was OAO, which was taken from a William Burroughs book and stood for Operation All Out. And then when Laswell and I split up, it became BC Studio. So once it became BC Studio without Laswell, Laswell would still come back a little bit. And I think his feeling is he's a bit of an alchemist. He kind of believes in like just, you know, as above, so below, right? So he tries to, you know, like if you want the thing above to be healthy, you have to look at the root, right? So he was always into keeping the root there. So he would come almost ritualistically to do something on the record just to dip the root back into the underground and his own roots, right? So he would do pieces of records. So like on the Ramones, Brain Drain, I think we just did like the odds and end couple of days where it's just a little bit of final touches on that record.
So did the band actually go there to record, or was it just a mixing process?
Joey and Johnny.
Okay.
Joey and Johnny came. And actually, Bill Laswell rented a Synclavier. Or it could have been a Fairlight, because those are the two instruments that were sort of co-equals. Fairlights and Synclavier. One of those was there. It required like three people to even move it into the studio. It was big
on a piece. Ramones track.
Yeah, on Brain Drain.
Isn't that the album with the Pet Sematary?
Yes. Yeah. So that was on there. Honestly, I don't. They got into a disagreement, actually, because I think that Joey...
When didn't they get into a disagreement? John and Joey Ramone?
No. With Laswell.
With Laswell, oh.
Joey got into... Because I think that Joey was eyeing some humor. I think that Joey wanted to lighten it up a little bit and was sort of interested in the sample library and the kind of stuff that might be on there. And even though that's what was rented and that was brought to the studio, I think Laswell didn't really want to get too funny, fucking around. That was the term I think Laswell used, that we're fucking around. But I think that that's kind of what Joey wanted to do. He wanted to fuck around. But anyway, similarly, Laswell wanted to bring a piece of the Iggy Pop record to, I think, just immerse the record back into a bit of its roots. And I think also to, for morale in the project, that you know, it's not just all fancy studios and it's casual. So Iggy Pop was, let me tell you, very casual in the studio. He would write songs in the studio. It was actually pretty chill. Like, he would show up and disappear in my studio, just writing in his journal all the time, writing. Sometimes we forgot. Sometimes I'd be like, should we get him? You know, because we'd be like ready to record and he's like somewhere like in the next room, like just writing. I'm like, I don't know, maybe we should record. Iggy, feel like singing? He goes, okay, I'm there. You know, and they'd come and sing on a song. And then he would lead us, he would leave me and Laswell to do the vocal composites, which is means going through the tracks that he sang and picking parts. Different artists feel differently about how you do vocal production. He didn't like sticking around for that stuff. He was like, it's all good. Maybe you all, both me and Laswell, you should figure out what parts are best. And he would say, maybe, you know, he would give names to his different performances. Here I was trying to croon more. Here I was trying to be more juvenile. Here, blah, blah, blah. And you sort of, so, but just figure out what works best in which sections. We would do that. And then Iggy would come in the next day. It happened a couple times where we had spent like 4 hours like making the composite of the vocal tracks. And Iggy would come in the next day and be like, you know, I have all new lyrics, just forget it. So we'd be like, oh, so it was very casual and a lot of fun. Actually, I remember that one day overlapped with St. Patrick's Day, which is a big
Irish thing.
A big Irish holiday in New York City where a lot of people dress in green. Well, Iggy was more green than anyone. I mean, he was head to toe. I think he might have had a top hat. I don't know. Maybe I'm imagining a top hat. But I definitely know he was in a lime green suit, maybe even shoes, like head to toe. I was like, wow, that's all. So that was St. Patrick's Day. And he knew I'd like it. Like, I opened the door and he was, hey, look who's here. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's great. You know, so it was a lot of fun and very casual for sure.
Do you get royalties from being an engineer or do you just get paid once?
Well, I don't get royalties. There's only one record in all these years where I get royalties, and that's the Dresden Dolls record. And I don't really know how that is, why that is.
Well, you co-wrote stuff.
I mean, it is true that on that record, I took on a little bit more of a producer role. Also, I think that they were very young. So, for instance, of the two Dresden Dolls, Brian, I think, might have been 19 or 20, maybe 19. And Amanda was 24. And I think the reason I get royalties on that is because, you know, as much as I assumed that record was never going to go anywhere, Amanda had an idea that maybe this record could do well. So it's funny, it does seem like even though I'm never the one that thinks anything's going to be successful and think people are a little off by even assuming that it might, you still require someone in there to believe that it's going somewhere. So I think because of that, Amanda was like, we need to talk about this like right off the bat. So for that reason, but I think that a lot of other records that did well, no one even really thought that they would do that well. Like that there would ever be an issue of money. So there was never a contract. So with Amanda, even though it was just a verbal agreement still. And now I actually, and one of the songs that, you know, I get royalties from is Coin Operated Boy. And that has been, I guess, it's one of those universal and eternal themes. So any generation of women is going to relate to the song about a coin-operated boy.
Coin-operated boy, sitting on the shelf. He is just a toy, but I turn him on and he comes to life. Automatic joy, that is why I want a coin operated boy. Made of plastic and elastic, he
birthday.
Who could ever, ever ask for more? Love without complications galore.
I think the sound there goes from monophonic to full stereo and full spectrum. In other words, suddenly there's low end and highs because it's small and mid-range. And then I turn them on, pop! And then right on the snare drum, it's like it suddenly comes to life. And then he comes to life and I turn him on, however it is. So that's a mixing trick. And you'll notice at the end of the song, it goes the other way around. It shrinks. So at the end, it actually shrinks. I want it to just shrink to like, it slows down. So it's like a retardando. And then I want it to just the stereo spectrum and the frequency spectrum to just go down to like bare minimum. So it starts small, gets bigger, and then just shrinks down. So there's some interesting mixing on that.
With my coin operated boy. This bridge was written to make you feel smitten with my sad picture of girl
gay. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
After collaborating with so many people, how did you start writing music on your own?
Well, I was always writing music during this whole time. I think some of it unreleased or whatever. So I was always screwing. I always did it for pleasure. I think that the first stuff I did on my first record, Creole Mass, I didn't know how to play any melodic instrument. So it was all just singing or creating things or asking people to play stuff. And I really did it for pleasure and stuff. And that record came out on a sort of subsidiary, a sort of side label to SST Records. It was this record label called New Alliance, which was originally Mike Watt from the Minutemen's. And it was the same record label that put out Ciccone Youth, which is another thing I recorded, which was a side project of Sonic Youth. So that was
where they covered Madonna's Into the Groove.
Right. They called it Into the Groovy. And that was like a split single, I think, with Mike Watt, actually. So that record came out on the same label that my first solo record came out. So really what it was that label was for, as I saw it at the time, artists that don't tour or like side projects. But interesting that there would even be a label that would put that out and print it. So that's when my first solo record happened. But I didn't pick up a guitar, I think because I still had some trauma from my parents, some trauma from my mom, and just thinking I have no musical talent at all, right? So I didn't even try to like pick up a guitar.
But she was on a level that, you know, most alternative rock musicians can't really reach. So
yeah, right. So so I was a little intimidated, and then I finally, I think around the age of 30. So when I finally hit like 30 years of age, I was like, you know, maybe I should try writing songs, you know. And so then I learned the basics of guitar and then got a little better. And then but then I, because basically it was a challenge, you always there's always a feeling of new territory, of breaking new territory, which has been through my whole life. I don't like staying in one place, and I don't even like saying challenging myself, but yeah, I guess it's challenging myself. It's just that there's something exciting about new processes because you don't know what the, you know, there could be some amazing outcomes. So that's what happened when that's what guitar was. So I was recording Sonic Youth. I'd never really picked up a guitar.
When did you start touring?
Touring happened in around maybe 2007, 2008. That happened at the during what I call the Napster era.
When recording budgets went down.
Well, recording budgets and the whole culture around recording and what recordings could do happened when there was a whole decline. It actually, and I support people having home studios. I think also some people should, you know, realize that home studios have limitations and then maybe it could be interesting to not do everything at home. And that's good, or else I wouldn't have a functioning recording studio, right? But back then it started seeming like, you know, like during the Napster era, so the early aughts or whatever, you know, 2005 or six or something, it felt like two things happened. It felt like albums were out and it was all about singles. So that affected the whole creative process and the whole excitement of recording albums. I figured, well, maybe albums will never come back. I didn't know. And it seemed like since people could do stuff at home and all of that, and that became increasingly popular, I wondered whether recording was going to be as powerful an art form. Because the thing that made me not interested so much in playing live and touring was that I felt that just with the sound, I felt like as a recording engineer, I was a sound artist, and the sound itself could blow people's minds. That's the language I used. So I try to remind people that we're not talking that, I'm not saying that the sound, okay, would be kind of good or we could be kind of creative. I was going way beyond good and creative. I meant nuclear level. Like I meant like the sound itself, people would be like, what the fuck? And their brains would feel like they were exploding. That's what I was after. Like powerful art, nuclear level sound. That's what I wanted. And then it's, and the impact, like impact from the sound. And along with, of course, compelling music and personalities. So that was this world that recording was, and it seemed to have disappeared. Sure, you need production. That's fine. But I was like, you know, if I was a kid coming into this now, like if I was a different age, right? So if I was coming into the possibility of recording in 2005, would I pick being a recording engineer? And the thought I had was, the answer I thought was maybe no. So I was like, why am I in this dying art form? So that's when I was like, you know what? Well, I'm a musician. That's all I care about, really. So maybe I should just focus on the thing that I've been neglecting all this time, which is performance and trying to reach people live and trying to like think about sound and live and performance. Am I going to blow anyone's mind? It's probably going to be in a DIY space somewhere, you know, with like amplifiers and drums and blah, blah, blah. So that's why I switched to touring. And I was, oh, maybe I need to take this on the road, etc.
And now you're off to blow people's minds at Larry's Corner in Stockholm. Thank you for coming here, Martin. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you, Frederick. Always happy to talk with music advocates as yourself.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Leon Media. Martin Bissi var hemma i Australien.